Well, please can you turn back in your Bibles to James chapter 1, page 1072. And together we can go through some of the verses that we read earlier. As I've said, last Sunday morning we looked at the opening 12 verses of James's letter, and the heading for last Sunday was, "Even trials are good for us." And this can seem a little bit counterintuitive, can't it? And as James well knows, but he gives us five reasons to explain what he was saying. Maybe you can remember some of them from last time. He told us, first of all, that trials lead to maturity, because the grimness of today forces us to place our hope in the future. And by striving towards the future, rather than languishing in the present, we develop maturity. But the Christian's hope, of course, wasn't just that things would become better in the future, because they might not. Rather, the Christian's hope was that he would become better in the future, and therefore more able to deal with the trials that would inevitably come. And the second reason that James told us that trials were good for us was because that trials lead us to God. You see, trials expose our needs. And the only place that the Christian knows to go when he's in need is to go straight to God. So trials lead us there. Not only that, but trials lead us to a stronger faith. And just as a climber has more confidence in his safety equipment after it has saved him, so a Christian has more confidence, more faith in God after God has brought him through trials. Trials lead to contentment also, said James last time, because when we've come through a difficult trial, we know that what we have must be sufficient, because it was enough to bring us through. Even if sometimes it doesn't seem as though it's very much, it was obviously enough. So trials lead to contentment. And finally, from last time, James told us that trials lead to glory. You see, trials are in an inevitable part of life, but they won't be part of eternity. They won't be part of heaven. So as every trial passes, we know that we're one step closer to being free from trials and difficulties and pain. One step closer to being forever with the Lord. So it's easy to see, isn't it, why James says even trials are good for us. But James wants to sound a cautionary note, because in the section that we're looking at this morning, he wants to address a problem that every one of us has faced. Because this morning, in verses 12 through to 18, James is going to look at this subject: when trials become temptations. When trials become temptations. You see, James spent the first 12 verses explaining how trials can build us up. But James is just like you and I, and he knows that sometimes that just doesn't happen. Sometimes trials don't build us up. Sometimes trials drag us down. Why is that? If trials are given us by God, does that mean it's God's fault when the trial becomes too much and we fail? Well, that's exactly the question that James is going to address today. And he does so by giving us 3 points. Now, firstly, in verses 12 and 13, he tells us that steadfastness in trials brings life. Steadfastness in trials brings life. Then in verses 14 and 15, he warns us that succumbing to temptations brings death. And finally, in verses 16 through 18, he tells us that security in trials is brought by God. Firstly then, from verses 12 and 13, steadfastness in trials brings life. Steadfastness in trials brings life. And you may remember that we dealt briefly with verse 12 at the end of last week. And we're returning to it today because it serves double duty in this letter. It brings to a close everything that James wanted to say about trials being good for us. But it also leads us to this new section that explains how trials become temptations. But before we can understand this section completely, I need to teach you a little bit of Greek. Now don't worry, it's very simple. Just one word. And I promise that it will be helpful. You see, in English, we think of a trial as something different to a temptation, don't we? If you look up trial in a thesaurus, at least in the is it thesauruses or thesauri? But the various thesauruses that I checked, if you look up trial in those books, it doesn't say temptation. They're two different things. You see, we normally think of a trial as something that we have to do that is particularly difficult, don't we? And a temptation is not something that we have to do that's difficult, it's something that we'd like to do, but we know we shouldn't. They're quite different things. But in Greek in the first century, they didn't have two different words as we do. They had just one, the word peirasmos. So you can go home, peirasmos, and impress your neighbours that you know some Greek. And this one word, peirasmos, had two different meanings. I looked it up in one of my Greek dictionaries, and it said that its first meaning was an attempt to learn the character of something. We might call that a test or a trial, mightn't we? But its second meaning was an attempt to make you do something wrong. And we might call that a temptation. You see, the problem is when we're interpreting James chapter 1 is that James uses that word right throughout the whole chapter. He uses it in verse 2 when he says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. And he uses the equivalent word peirasso throughout verses 13 and 14 when he says that God tempts no one. Even though earlier the trials have come from God. So we have to be very careful how we interpret these verses to make sure we translate in this word peirasmos properly. But actually, when I think about it, I think the Greeks probably had it about right by just having this one word. I think it would be easier if English did the same. Now let me tell you about Dave. Dave doesn't exist, but this is his story. Dave is a bit overweight and he thinks about going on a diet. And his wife Deborah thinks that this is a wonderful idea. And because Deborah works for Children in Need, she suggests that he goes on a sponsored diet. And Dave agrees and sets off to find some sponsors. Now it seems that Dave's friends haven't got too much confidence in his diet because they're very generous in their sponsor money. And people are encouraged to sponsor him a pound for a pound. Well, his diet starts off very well for the first few weeks and he begins to lose some weight. And his wife, Deborah, is very careful to buy lots of low-calorie food and to hide the biscuits. And then one day, there's some people are coming over to Dave's house for a meal. And of course, for the first time in weeks, there's pudding on offer. And the pudding happens to be Dave's favourite, triple chocolate cake. So as Deborah goes to the kitchen to bring out the pudding, she thinks to herself, this is going to be a real test for Dave. We'll see whether he's really committed to this diet now. Well, I'm not going to tell you whether Dave ate the cake, but I will tell you that a few weeks later, he and Deborah found himself at Linda's house for a meal. Now, Linda was one of the ladies who'd sponsored Dave a pound for a pound. And as Dave comes through the door, she realizes that she's lost an awful lot of money already. At this rate, Dave's diet's going to cost her a fortune. So when it's time for pudding, Linda says to herself, now let's see if I can tempt Dave here, and brings out a triple chocolate cake. Now what's the point of the story other than to make you feel very hungry? Well, simply this. From Dave's point of view, exactly the same thing happened in those two places. A great big triple chocolate cake. But on one occasion, Dave was being tested by his wife. And on the other, he was being tempted. Do you see the difference? When his wife brought out the cake, she wanted him to pass the test. But when Linda brought out the cake, she wanted him to succumb to the temptation. So let's read verse 13 again. Let no one say when he is tempted or tested, remember the word means both, I am tempted by God. Do you see what James is saying? God will send us all kinds of trials in life, but God always wants us to pass the test. He never wants us to succumb to temptation. God never encourages us to sin. Now, I hope that illustration helps us to see how God never tempts us, because he always wants us to pass the test. But perhaps some of you can see a problem with this. The problem is that we know from our own experience that we often fail tests. So if God wants us to pass, why is it that we often fail? Does that mean it's God's fault when we fail? That's the question that is addressed for us next. Well, maybe another illustration will go some way to answering that question. Imagine this time a teacher in school diligently preparing her pupils for an exam. Let's call her Mrs. Jones. And Mrs. Jones teaches her calc class very carefully, doing the very best that she can to ensure that all of them know exactly what's required of them and they understand their subject properly. And soon she knows it's important that she tests them to see how much they've learned. And what makes it doubly difficult is that Mrs. Jones has the job that none of the other teachers wants. She's teaching the bottom sets, the class where everyone is used to failing. But Mrs. Jones has worked hard, you see. And she knows that with her help, every one of them should be able to pass the test. But despite that, she is concerned about one or two in the class. So in the weeks leading up to the test, she uses her class time for revision. She gives up her lunch break in order to run tutorials. She even offers individual tuition to those pupils who are really struggling. There really is nothing Mrs. Jones isn't doing to help her class pass the test. And the day of the test comes. And Mrs. Jones is confident that her hard work will pay off. She's confident her class will pass the test. Confident of everybody, that is, apart from little Johnny. Johnny, you see, has always struggled. It's not that he's stupid, he just doesn't put the effort in. And his grades were poor, but Mrs. Jones is not convinced he's been revising. And he certainly hasn't been to any of her tutorials, and he's definitely not come for one-to-one tuition. So at the end of the exam, Mrs. Jones collects all the papers in. And she was absolutely right. They've all passed. Well, everyone, that is, apart from Johnny. Johnny's not done at all well. There are whole sections completely unanswered, and he's finished with a poor grade. What should Mrs. Jones do? Well, she could, of course, pretend that Johnny's wrong answers are really right. She could sweep his lack of effort under the carpet. Nobody would find out. She set the test. It's up to her how it's marked. Or perhaps she could put in correct answers where Johnny's left it blank. She's always been pretty good at writing in other people's handwriting. So what should Mrs. Jones do? Well, as she sits at her desk with Johnny's paper in her hand, she knows that her decision will decide whether Johnny passes or fails. Some senses it's down to her. And what makes it worse is that Mrs. Jones really wants Johnny to pass his test. So what should Mrs. Jones do? Well, of course, there's only one thing that she can do, isn't there? It may be possible for her to treat what is wrong as if it were right, or to add to what Johnny has done. It may be possible to do so, but it wouldn't be right, would it? So despite the fact that Mrs. Jones really wants Johnny to pass, when Johnny gets his exam paper back, he sees that he's failed. But there was no way that Johnny could blame Mrs. Jones that he'd failed, could he? Yes, it was Mrs. Jones who set the test. It was her who decided what was right and what was wrong. But it was Johnny's responsibility alone that he failed, because he refused the help that had been offered. It's just worth mentioning, before we close the story, Freddie. Freddie was typical of everybody else in the class. And when he had his exam paper back, he saw to his great surprise that he'd passed the test. He never thought it possible, but he knew exactly why. "Thank you," he says to Mrs. Jones. "It's all down to you. If it wasn't for you, I'd never have passed." And Freddie was right. It really was all down to Mrs. Jones. If it wasn't for her, he'd never have passed. But it was entirely Johnny's fault that Johnny had failed. Now, that's not a perfect illustration, and it doesn't answer every question about God's sovereignty and our responsibility. But it goes a long way, I think, to answering the question, if God wants us to pass, why do we sometimes fail? It shows us just a little insight into what the Bible teaches us. When we fail, it really is down to us. We cannot blame God at all. But when we pass, then it's really all down to Him, and we can't take any credit at all. So I hope now we understand verse 13, just a little better. God doesn't tempt us, but he does test us, and he always wants us to pass the tests. But let's go back just very briefly back to verse 12, because there James gives us the positive application of the truths of verse 13. Remember that perasmos can be translated as either trials or temptations. Remember that God never gives us temptations to make us fail. He only ever gives us trials that he wants us to pass. So what does verse 12 say from God's perspective? We have to do a little bit of retranslating here. Verse 12 from God's perspective says something like this. Blessed is the man who endures testing. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. You see, God not only wants us to stand the test, but he equips us to stand the test, and he also promises a reward, the crown of life, to those who do so. What is a crown of life? Well, nowadays when we think of crowns, we tend to think of the queen, don't we? That's the image that naturally pops into my head, at least. But I don't think that's what would have been in James's mind. He probably would have thought, first of all, of the competitors in ancient games, who were given a crown of laurel leaves when they had endured their particular tests. And we know what a crown of laurel leaves is made of, don't we? So we know too what a crown of life is made of. It's God's gift to us, life. That's God's gift, that's God's crown to us, life. To those of us, what does verse 12 say? Who love him. What a wonderful gift of life. Elsewhere we'll read, everlasting life. That's God's promise to those who love him. So how obvious, surely then, that God never tempts us. If God has promised this wonderful reward that is given to all those who love him and whom he loves, how clear it is that God would never want us to fail, that God always wants us to endure. And surely then, we ought to live in the light of that glorious promise. So that was James's first point. Steadfastness in trials brings life. And that's the positive side of the coin. But now James wants to move on to the more negative, because his second point from verses 14 and 15 is this. Succumbing to temptations brings death. Succumbing to temptations brings death. Let's read those verses together. Verse 14. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, he gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. You see, James here is making it very clear why we sometimes fail. God can't be blamed, he has said. We need to shoulder responsibility ourselves. Now, in some ways, I think these two verses are fascinating as much for what they leave out as what they put in. Do you notice what's missing from verses 14 and 15? You see, if we'd never read these verses from James, and I was to ask you, why are you tempted? I wonder what you'd have said. Perhaps your answer would have mentioned the media, or the influence of friends, or advertising and marketing. Or perhaps you'd have talked about the devil deliberately tempting you in order to make you stumble and fall. And perhaps some of us would not have mentioned the very thing, the only thing, in fact, that James feels is important here. Why am I tempted? James doesn't say the media, or friends, or the devil. Why am I tempted? What does James say? Well, really, I can only blame myself. It's not that James doesn't believe in the devil. Chapter 4 makes it clear that he does. And of course, like all men, he understands the pressures the world brings on us. But James knows his own heart, and therefore he knows your heart and my heart too. And James knows that his biggest problem is not the world, it's not the devil, but it's his flesh, his own sinful nature. And that's why he can say each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. You see, James's purpose in these two verses is very clear. He wants first to explain how temptation comes, and then to explain where temptation leads. And temptation comes, verse 14, as a result of our own desires. That's what turns a test into a temptation, our desire. The Greek word is epithumia. You don't need to remember that one. It's a strong word. It's often got very negative connotations, as it does here, but it always refers to a longing, a craving. It's not just something we want, it's something that drives us. And this is James's problem. And I'm glad the Bible is honest with us, aren't you? Because if we really are converted, then we know these battles that rage in our hearts. We know that our sinful nature seeks to turn every test into a temptation. We know that whilst God wants us to pass our tests, something perverse inside us wants to make us fail. So that's where temptation comes from, James tells us in verse 14. It comes from inside. It's part of us. But where does it lead? That's his next section, verse 15. Where does temptation lead? Well, here in verse 15, we have an illustration that we're all very familiar with, that of a family growing up. These evil desires, James says, will conceive and then give birth to a far more dangerous child, sin. And this child called sin then itself will grow and grow, and eventually sin too will have a child. Death. That's what James says in verse 15. And there's an awesome inevitability to this, isn't there? There is a natural and frightening consequence to our sinful desires. Our desires, James says, if they're allowed to live, will soon bring death. I'm not a gardener, but there are one or two things that I know about gardening. And because we're trying to sell our house at the moment, probably for the first time, we're a bit concerned about weeds, particularly on the path up to the house. So before we put our house on the market, we spend a long time pulling up weeds, and then we spray the whole path with weed killer just for good measure. Now, of course, despite what it said on the spray can, in a matter of weeks, the weeds were back. Now, they were only very tiny, but they were definitely back. Well, maybe my trust in the weed killer was not advised, but I thought little of it. We went away to camp, we went away to the conference, and by the time we come back, things had moved on quite a bit on our path. And one weed in particular was literally several inches tall. I could ignore it no longer. And would you believe, it was only a month after we'd applied that weed killer on quite a short path, I managed to fill a 5-gallon bucket just with weeds. So much for season-long weed killer. Well, I wanted to remind you that there is no such thing as season-long weed killer in the Christian life either. The battle against our desires and against sin is an ongoing one that requires constant treatment. God has told us that the battle will come to an end, but it will only do so when we're in glory. Now, thankfully, the weeds in our garden never became full-grown, and I pray that the sin in your life will never become full-grown either. But you know, and I know, that the easiest, the best way to tackle sin is to root it out as soon as we can and never to let it grow. You see, once we allow our minds to settle on what is wrong, once we start to feed our evil desires, it's only a matter of time before sin becomes prevalent. So what can we do to root out our sin? Well, here James doesn't tell us, but he will spend much of the letter dealing with exactly these problems. It's not that James shirks the issues, but he wants to spend time dealing with it. And throughout the letter, he tackles some of the biggest issues, the biggest problems that we face. He tackles the desires to turn a living faith into a dead religion. He tackles our desires to use our tongues for evil instead of good. He tackles our desires for one-upmanship and putting other people down. And so it goes on. The whole letter is about tackling and rooting out these sins. But I don't want to jump ahead too far. So let's just go a few verses ahead, because we do need to deal with this question. What can we do to root out our sin? Let's jump to verse 21, which is the first place that James deals with it. We'll be looking at this verse in more detail next time. But it'd be wrong to state the problem this morning and give us no hope for an answer, wouldn't it? So we need to go to verse 21. What does it say? Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. You see, it might not be season-long weed killer, but if it's constantly reapplied, the implanted word is enormously effective. And there's a great challenge in verse 21, as we'll come to see next time, but there's a great encouragement here too. The encouragement is that if we're a believer, then we already have the means to defeat our desires. Do you notice where the word is in verse 21? It's the implanted word. Now, when I was doing my garden, I had to go to the shed and get out the weed killer and spray it around. It would be really good if I could somehow implant my bottle of weed killer into the ground, and magically, whenever it was needed, it would squirt out and kill the weeds. Well, my weed killer is not implanted, but the word which kills sin is implanted. But it needs to be received, verse 21 says. Nowadays, as you know, it's relatively common for people to have heart and lung transplants and all kinds of other organs too. But again, as you know, when surgeons attempt the operation, there's often a problem that the body rejects the new organ and starts to fight it, even though the new organ will save the patient's life. And that's exactly the problem that some Christians have, James says. Some of us reject the implanted word, even though it's able to save us. It's the gospel. It's the word that brought us to Christ. And it's the gospel and that word that not only brought us to Christ, but will also keep us and aid us in our battle against sin. Imagine someone who was dying, and then they received, let's say, a kidney transplant, and it saved their life. And over time, they were amazed at the transformation that this new kidney had provided for them. And they discovered after a time that it made them better. And all the things that they used to struggle with, now there wasn't a struggle at all. So this obviously means, they say to themselves, I don't need this new kidney any longer. It's done its work. I can now live without it. What foolishness. But that's exactly what some Christians do. It's the gospel that saves them. But they think that now they're converted and some of their old battles are done away with. Now they don't need the gospel anymore. But it's the gospel, you see. It's our thoughts of Christ. It's our remembering of all that Jesus Christ has done that will put to death our sinful desires. And the very same thing that saved us, verse 21, is the very thing that we need to receive with meekness. That which is already implanted in us. The gospel, it will be, that kills our weeds, the gospel that keeps giving us life. We must always focus on the gospel. But before we move on, I want to say something to those of us here this morning who are playing with sin. Because we need to look carefully, don't we, at what James is saying. I'm back now in verse 15. When desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. I've got a friend in Wrexham called Andrew. When Andrew was about 13, he was as tall as I am now. He is now 6'7" and wears size 15 shoes. And he's still only a teenager. And apparently, Andrew has not stopped growing. Who knows, his family say, when he'll be full grown. And no one knows when your sin will be full grown either. And if you're playing with sin, then we all know, you included, that your sin is growing. And one day, James says, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, but one day, your sin will be full grown. And at that point, it will bring forth death. The conclusion surely is obvious to those who are playing with sin. We cannot afford to take these risks. And that leads us then onto James's final point. He's told us that steadfastness in trials brings life. He's warned us that succumbing to temptation brings death. And finally, in verses 16 through to 18, he tells us that security in trials is brought by God. Security in trials is brought by God. Verses 16 through 18 say this: Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So as James brings to a conclusion this section on when trials become temptations, he does so by lifting our eyes well beyond ourselves. He tells us very clearly in verse 16 that he doesn't want us to be deceived. That's why he went to so much trouble to explain that God does not tempt us. He only tests us. And not only that, he tells us that God gives us the means to be able to pass those tests. And that's why James is more than confident to say in verse 17 that every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. Do you remember what we learned last week from verse 5? If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given of him. You see, the only way that we will endure the test is if we can stop our desires turning God's tests into temptations. And God is more than willing, James tells us, to give us all the gifts that we need in order that that might indeed happen. God is a God who gives. But notice how else James describes God in verse 17. These gifts come down from the Father of lights. Well, what a wonderful description of God. It's unique in the New Testament, but it's full of meaning. And I think James is reminding himself that God here is the creator of the universe. He's the Father of all the heavenly lights, in other words. It also reminds us of God's openness and God's honesty, God's ability to cut through the darkness, to expose us, to enlighten our path. And it's this God, James says, who is the source of these wonderful gifts. And this has been the case for generations. And it's just as true today. Because this God, James says, verse 17, in whom there is no variation. God doesn't change, in other words. If this God gave good gifts in James's day, then he'll still be giving good gifts in our day. If he was a caring God in your youth, then he remains a caring God in your old age, because God doesn't change. And throughout our lives, things will change. Even things that we think of as unchangeable seemed to change. Last evening, after we'd finished here, my parents wanted to have a look at down on Factory Road, where we were hoping to buy, and as we came, and my dad tried to turn around in Factory Road, but as we just about on a 15-point turn turned round, we could see in front of us the mountain coming down here, and the sun was going down, and the mountain, oh, it looked incredibly different with its orange light shining on it to how it normally looks. Well, the mountain hadn't changed. But the way that the sun was moving across the sky made it look as though it had changed. The shadows fell in different places. Those of you who take photographs will know what a difference shadow can make to the picture you're trying to take. But you see what James is saying here. God is the source of all light. Then change in other things doesn't affect God. There is no variation or shadow of turning, even with God. And this, of course, gives the Christian total security. You see, James teaches us that our ability to persevere rests on divine gifts alone. And because he teaches us that the God who gives those gifts doesn't change, the inevitable conclusion is that God's gifts won't dry up. They'll always be there for us. And it means that we can feel tremendous security, even in our trials, even when we don't know the future. But James, wonder of it all, is not content merely to remind us that God cannot change. He also wants us to remember that God has completely changed us. Look at verse 18. Of his own will, James says, he brought us forth by the word of truth. What a contrast to verse 15. Do you remember verse 15? When sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death, whereas God, who's always been full grown, if I can put it like that, brings us forth, gives us life. And look at how James describes it. Of his own will, God brings us forth. Another Greek word for you, boulomai. And it's a wonderful word. It means desire. But it means much more than that. And it's a wonderful contrast to our desires from verse 15. You see, the dictionary says about boulimai, it's to desire or to have or experience something, but listen to this, with the implication of planning accordingly. Isn't that wonderful? You see, the problem with our own desires is that they come, often very unexpectedly, and almost take control. Maybe some of you are more disciplined than I am, but it doesn't take very much for me to get very distracted from what I'm doing. It only needs a cake shop or McDonald's or something like that, and I'm off. But not so with God, you see. His desires are completely in His control. They don't control Him. And He carefully plans to ensure that His desires come to fruition. Our passions shift and change. His will is settled and determined. And it is that that allows James to describe Him as the Father of lights, the Creator of the universe. And it's that will, verse 18, that brings us forth by the word of truth, by the gospel, in other words. And never forget that God's word brings people forth, brings people life by the word of truth. What a striking example then of God's good and faithful giving, this gift of the word of truth. And if that was not enough, then James reminds us that this is only the start, the end of verse 18 now. God's will in saving us is wonderful, James says, but God has much greater plans than your salvation and mine. You see, our salvation is merely a part of God's great plan of redemption, which will encompass countless generations of every nation and even creation itself. We're simply a kind of first fruits, an initial harvest, James says, of all that will one day be redeemed. So truly, we worship a remarkable God. So, steadfastness in trials brings us life. Succumbing to temptation brings death. But security in trials is brought by God.